The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
Now, this week, after months of assumptions that LIV Golf was on its last legs, its chief executive said they have secured funding to keep it alive. Since its inception, Saudi investments in LIV have totaled more than $5 billion, and it has faced accusations of sports washing. But why do sports fans seem to pick and choose when to care about sports washing? Many of us this summer would criticise FIFA President Gianni Infantino and all the antics there about hydration breaks and the red card interference and so on, and indeed the treatment of the visiting Iranian team and a Somali referee who was not allowed in to do his job. We criticised all of that, but still we sat back and we enjoyed all the football. Are we being hypocritical by being so anti-LIV and, pro-World Cup, given all the goings-on? Is our sport tunnel vision so bad that we only care about these things when they're in the tunnel with us? Well, joining us now to talk about all of this and a little bit more is sports correspondent with the Irish Times, Gavin Cooney. Gavin, good morning.
Morning, Pat. How are things?
Very well. And first of all, I suppose we should mention the big sporting set piece today in Croke Park. The camogie is on.
Yeah, Galway and Cork. I mean, this is the chief rivalry in the sport at the moment, and this is almost the decider in a best of three series. The sides have met in each of the previous two All Irelands. It's one win each. It was very physical, quite saucy end to last year's final, which further seeds that sense of a true rivalry. So, all sports want great rivalries. That sells the sport better than anything else. Camogie currently has that. So it's the best of three decider later on today between Galway and Cork.
Yeah, and it's interesting. We talked about Kerry and Galway last week in the football and how that ended in some pretty severe controversy.
I was highly traumatic, wasn't it? I mean, it was quite a poor game, really, up until the final few minutes. But it was like a standard, B movie Hollywood script where the exposition is fairly lengthy and ho hum, but it's redeemed by the drama of the finale. Mm. It would seem that the referee Maggie Farrelly did get things correct, even though it wasn't apparent to most fans at the time. It was a definite square ball in that kind of denouement for Siafar O'Shea's free kick that dropped short. There was a Kerry player inside the square, so that was the correct decision. And she obviously had pulled that decision back for an earlier advantage that wasn't accruing, but under the rules that was correct as well. So while some Kerry fans left with a sense of grievance, I think the rule book certainly vindicated the referee.
It also, I suppose it vindicates the whole thing of the hooter. Do you know in sports where the time is random, and it's in rugby even where the time is not random, you know, they stop the clock during any injuries or whatever, and then they start the clock again. The referee has discretion at the end to how long the play may go on until the ball goes dead, and then the 40 minutes is up. But the hooter, I mean, it's absolutely, once it goes, it goes, it's over.
It's over, and it really adds to the drama of everything. And it's been quite a controversial addition to the men's game this year, but I really thought it edified the drama of the men's final, because Mayo have been waiting for 75 years to win the All-Ireland, and it was they would treat Sam Maguire almost as a kind of an apparition. I'll believe it when I see it. And actually, because they knew that there wouldn't be any additional time added, that they knew when the hooter blew, it was all over. There was actually an amazing moment in that match when they realised when Tommy Conroy had scored that punched that ball over the bar for the final point. There was a moment when Mayo fans realised, hang on, we're actually finally going to do this. We can't mess this up from here. So from that perspective, I really thought the hooter added to the drama, as it did in the ladies' final the week after.
Now, we want to talk about sports washing generally, but I suppose we can't really talk about FIFA and all of that and their antics without referring to this week for Gianni Infantino. It looked like Infantino was going to not quite survive, but improve his prospects of survival after the meeting where he got the backing of his own board. But then there were revelations.
It's an extraordinary story now at this point. There were indeed revelations. Yeah, so he used to work at UEFA, and UEFA confirmed in a story to the Telegraph, I think it ran on Saturday, in Saturday's newspaper, that while he was working at UEFA, UEFA made a payoff to a mistress of Gianni Infantino's. So while UEFA confirmed that they did indeed do that years and years ago, Infantino has denied the accusations. So it just goes to show just what an ugly and unseemly war is now breaking out in football. Gianni Infantino, once of UEFA, but now the FIFA president is digging his heels in. He's refusing to leave office. He has supporters right across the world, primarily really in the global south, in South America and in Africa, some in the Caribbean and some in Asia as well. But UEFA in Europe are determined to get rid of this guy. They've seen quite enough of Gianni Infantino. So what we're setting in now is for a long and quite unseemly civil war in football. UEFA, as it stands, are boycotting FIFA competitions. It seems that they're going to make that the end of that boycott contingent on Infantino stepping down. So we're now in a really extraordinary scenario where, you know, in theory, the National Ireland women's team are in World Cup playoffs in October of this year. As it stands, those games are being boycotted. So if there's no resolution to this, all of a sudden it will be women's footballers whose careers will be hurt by this ongoing standoff. So look, maybe things will be resolved in time, yeah. But both sides seem completely intractable at the moment.
It makes you kind of nostalgic for the innocent years of Sepp Blatter.
Oh God, you know, it's amazing that this guy seemed like Sepp Blatter was never a widely respected guy, but now he seems to have a certain kind of almost kind of moral code that Gianni Infantino does, in the sense that Sepp Blatter never messed with the game, really. You know, I mean, for all of the corruption that emerged during Sepp Blatter's regime, there was nothing, so nothing was ever allowed to meddle with the game itself. He never introduced VAR. He would never introduce the hydration breaks at the World Cup. So I think actually that speaks to what you're saying in your intro, that we maintain tunnel vision until these things join us in the tunnel.
Now, let's go to LIV Golf. And for people who don't know, LIV is really the Roman numerals for 54. So L for 50 and the 1V giving you 4. So that's how the title came around. But basically, it was a Saudi wheeze.
It was indeed. It was a breakaway golf league formed in, I think it was 2022, backed by the Saudi Public Investment Fund, when that Saudi Public Investment Fund, which is the sovereign wealth fund of Saudi Arabia, was investing in sport left, right and centre, notionally as a kind of to diversify their economy away from oil, but obviously had its own sports washing benefits as a result. It detonated a bomb in the world of golf, we would have to say, caused an extraordinary civil war in which so many of the top players left the established PGA Tour to go play on this rebel circuit. You know, big names, Phil Mickelson, Dustin Johnson, Bryson DeChambeau, and then latterly John Rahm. But LIV Golf never really won the hearts and minds of golf fans. The Scheffler and Rory McIlroy stuck with the PGA Tour, and it was the PGA Tour that retained the bulk of the golf fan that would sit down and watch on a Saturday or Sunday evening outside of the majors. It was always a sense that this thing was never really financially viable. And now the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund announced earlier this year that they were withdrawing all funding from LIV Golf, having sunk, as you say, more than $5 billion into the thing. So naturally, it raised massive doubts as to how this thing survives. So the CEO, Scott O'Neill, as you said earlier this week, said that they have signed a term sheet with an investor to allow LIV to continue. But he was very, very light on the details. You know, we don't know how much money is being put in. We don't know what the business will look like going forward into next year. There was actually reports then that it was actually more of a loan than an investment. But certainly, I think we can say without any doubt, to quote a man from our own history, that LIV Golf is definitely living beyond its means.
Now, what about football itself? I mean, when you get people investing, be they Russians or Saudis or other Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds who invest in, say, Premier League, I mean, how much of that is sports washing? How much of it is sensible investment?
Some of it is sensible investment, I guess. If you look at the American owners of Liverpool got the club when they were threatened with bankruptcy for for, you know, a song and a dance, really. You know, I mean, it was something like £350 million. The former Liverpool owner who lost the club described it as an epic swindle. And now the club is valued at, you know, in billions. You know, we saw Chelsea being taken over by American investors at valued at something like $4 billion. So there is definite long-term value there. But at the same time, it's hard to turn an annual profit running these clubs, you know, because the price of the wages, you know, the labor in football commands a huge amount of the income. That's what makes it very different to a lot of other businesses. The old line that how do you make a small fortune in football? We start off with a big fortune. And when you see the money being pumped into the likes of Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain, Newcastle United for a little while, even though the Saudis seem to be resiling from that investment, you realize that you can't possibly be running this to make a profit, that you're actually running this for another reason. And obviously it's sports washing, right? It's a kind of an image laundering. It's to, you know, to normalize yourself among the rest of the world as someone with whom you can do business.
Now, the whole question of Israel, and we've been talking a lot about Israel on the program, but the question of Israel's participation in sports, you know, the Russians get dumped out of this and that, including, you know, as well as sport, the Eurovision Song Contest, Israel persists. Are there double standards at work right across the world?
I think there is, yeah. I mean, with respect to the Israel situation, I mean, the Palestinian FA lodged an official complaint at FIFA citing that the Israeli FA had violated FIFA's own rules and own statutes with regard to the failure to enact a proper anti-discrimination policy, and also that the Israeli FA organized matches on occupied Palestinian territory in the West Bank. And whereas FIFA and UEFA were very quick, they kicked Russia out within days, because Poland and another number of nations who were due to play Russia in World Cup playoffs effectively refused to do so. They dragged their heels for, you know, it took nearly 2 years for FIFA to come to a decision on Israel, and they just decided to hit them with a derisory fine and then just carry on as normal. So among the many Irish fans calling for a boycott of these forthcoming games against Israel in the Nations League, I think a lot have quite a lot of sympathy, especially with the Irish players and management. And there is some sympathy, I believe, with the FAI that they are in the position of having to adjudicate on this and whether it's right or wrong to play Israel, whereas their bosses, UEFA and FIFA, have just shirked the decisions. So,
if we were a bigger country, I mean, now France has, I think, the single biggest Jewish population in Europe. They might not rock the boat. We know that Germany has a guilt complex over the Holocaust and all of that. Mm. They might not have rocked the boat. But we're certainly too small to rock the boat, aren't we?
That's the FAI's view, effectively, that, you know, and it reminds me of, you'll remember there was a big controversy a couple of years ago when the Irish women's basketball team was drawn to play Israel in a Eurobasket qualifier. And the CEO of Basketball Ireland spoke very, very boldly at the time and said, I'm not going to boycott this event for a gesture that will have no impact and may risk ruining my sport, given the punitive sanctions that Irish basketball would be hit if they didn't fulfill a qualifier, be it against Israel or anyone else. And the FAI are basically the same. They say, look, we'd be isolated out here if we made this boycott, and it wouldn't have the intended effect, because Ireland are also co-hosting Euro 2028 as co-hosts of a UEFA jamboree and as one of UEFA's main money-making schemes. If Israel were to qualify, Ireland wouldn't have the power to say, no, you can't play here, or that Ireland won't play here. So that's very much the view, is that little old Ireland can't stand out here by itself, because, you know, what difference will our voice make? I mean, a lot of people are now pointing correctly to the very bitter irony that the FAI find themselves in that as it stands in October, they're boycotting two matches. But it's not the men's matches against Israel, it's the women's matches in the World Cup playoffs. And, you know, people are wondering, wait, hang on a minute, why are the FAI suddenly in favour of a boycott, having told us they can't boycott the Israel games? Yeah. But the answer is that they stand with UEFA, that they're one, you know, they're UEFA are kind of their main source of income and money. So in both of those respects, as kind of contradictory as it seems, they're a small football association feeling the need to stand with their European partners.
Now, the other question which one of the listeners has raised, what about Dunbeg and Trump, given Trump's you know, behavior on the world stage and domestic behavior, tariffs, everything else? You know, he's isolationist and whether or not there are questions people have to ask themselves about supporting the Irish Open in Doonbeg.
Absolutely. I mean, my Irish Times colleague Justine McCarthy had a very good piece only a couple of weeks ago pointing out that, you know, at least that the FAI are getting a lot of heat and there's been so much talk and controversy around the playing of the Israel games, whereas there's been hardly a peep of criticism around golfers going to play the Irish Open, around the decision of the European Tour and the Irish government to back the decision of playing this event in Doonbeg. So I think it absolutely throws up questions as to, you know, Trump loves golf, you know, his two main sports are mixed martial arts and golf. You know, this is not a man of easily reconcilable interests. And he has a natural kind of financial interest in hosting the Irish Open at Doonbeg because it's great promotion for another of his businesses. Yeah. But, you know, Trump has mixed business with politics in a manner that, you know, should really be unconscionable in American politics. And sadly, Ireland is allowing him to, you know, use our National Golf Open to do exactly the same.
And Gavin, a number of listeners talking about Ireland playing cricket against Afghanistan, hardly a country with a great human rights record, you know, where girls can't go to school once they reach a certain age. I mean, is this the kind of country we should be doing any business with?
I don't think so, Pat, to be honest. I mean, I don't, maybe there's benefits for Cricket Ireland in playing these internationals against a big nation like Afghanistan. But certainly, as far as I understand it, the English Cricket Board and the England cricket team refused to play Afghanistan. And again, it just goes to show how complicated and complex all of these things are. And, you know, some people would say it's just sport. We shouldn't be taking moral stances on these things, because if you take a moral stance of one thing, then you have to be seen to take moral stances and all of these things. But when it comes to national teams, and, you know, national teams are meant to represent the people of that nation, I think it's fair to interrogate all of these things. And while the FAI have had to face more questions than the other sports that we've just talked about here, I think everyone is coming to the same response, that sport nowadays is a business and we got to get on with the business of making money.
Yeah. And of course, we're not without sin ourselves. I mean, the FAI got a huge amount of money. Was it 5 million for the Thierry Henry handball, the handball that was real? You know, we got paid off, didn't we?
We got paid off. Yeah, that was another little instance in showing how FIFA worked when we were campaigning to be the 33rd team at the World Cup. We got this 5 million euro payment from FIFA effectively to shut us up. And, you know, it didn't come out until I think Neil O'Riordan revealed it in the Irish Sun for quite a while after. So that was, that was an instance of the FAI back all those years ago playing along with the rules of FIFA, which...
I'm going to leave you, Gavin, and thank you very much for joining us with this quotation about Gary Lineker. He said 10 years ago, Infantino was Sepp Blatter in a mask. So there you are. Gavin Cooney, sports correspondent, Irish Times. Thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.